The idea of a natural world in balance, a world of symmetry and purpose, is a pretty appealing idea. The idea of the balance of nature is one that goes back ages. It was embraced by the Greeks, who found it especially compelling, and it's persisted to this day. Our guest this hour says the idea is a dangerous one, though, that it interferes with our stewardship of the Earth in an era of climate change. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour is the Manili Professor of Biology at Wheaton College and the author of the book we're talking about today called The Balance of Nature, Ecology's Enduring Myth. And we welcome your calls this morning, too. Do you think that the idea of a balanced world, a balanced natural world, is a myth, or do you believe in the purpose of each living thing? And what do we risk by aligning ourselves with a belief in an ordered natural world? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. The call-in is 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. John Kreischer, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Veronica. My pleasure.
Well, I want to start out by laying out exactly what we mean when we talk about the idea of nature in balance. What does that mean?
Well, the concept of balance of nature doesn't really mean much of anything. It's one of those things that sounds better than it really is. It's more of an assumption and belief than it is any kind of scientific paradigm. And I suppose what it means to most people is that nature has some kind of a normal state that it arranges itself in, and that's a state of what you would call balance or equilibrium. And that does trace its roots back to the Greeks, but it has continued to flourish in Western society and even was a major part of ecology for most of the 20th century, at least the first half or two-thirds of it. But I think the other assumption of the balance of nature concept is that somehow humans are apart from nature, at least in our culture, and that what we do, our activities, continues to erode the balance of nature, and that we have to strive to try and maintain it. But we don't really know what we're striving to maintain because there wasn't really any balance there in the first place, and that's something that ecologists have learned. It doesn't in any way undermine the need for strong policies of conservation and serious decision-making in this century with regard to such influences, climate change and reduction of natural areas, fragmentation of forests, and that sort of thing. None of that can be ignored, and in fact, it should be a priority. But relying on the balance of nature is the underpinning for the philosophy behind conservation, I think is a very outmoded and probably useless idea.
Well, it seems as though that idea can take some different forms. On the one hand, when we talk about the balance of nature, sometimes people mean that it's perfect and it will sort itself out if we just get out of the way. Sometimes it seems to mean that nature in all of its guises has a purpose, from, you know, the tiniest bug to the biggest of the animals. What do you think about when we sort of ascribe purpose to nature?
I don't think nature has any purpose at all in the sense that you describe it. I don't think that it's some kind of complex machine in time and space that is set up to work in a specific way that ultimately is to the, quote, good or not good of whomever. I think what nature is, and if we look back in geological time, and there's been life on Earth for 3.5 billion years, the planet's been around for 4.6 billion years, but if we look at the history of life on Earth, we see it's constantly changing. It's often significantly disrupted. There is a massive amount of empirical evidence for the continued changes in ecosystems that we see today. One of the problems we face, for instance, in many areas, like, for instance, ranging from the Galapagos Islands to various places in North America, is that of invasive species which are native to other areas but come into an ecosystem and change it in a very significant way. There's just no empirical evidence for balance. And as far as purpose is concerned, purpose is very misleading because I don't think a Tyrannosaurus that lived 65 million years ago had a purpose. I think a Tyrannosaurus functioned as an animal, as all animals function. It tried to feed itself, it tried to reproduce, it tried to survive from one day to another. Eventually it died, eventually the species became extinct. That's what biology is. It doesn't undermine the fascination a lot of people take with thinking about what a Tyrannosaurus must have been, what it must have looked like, what it must have sounded like. I don't think purpose is a necessary part of the way we perceive biology. And as I said, the reason I think that is because it's misleading. Organisms, if they have purpose, were created. But organisms weren't created, I believe, and most of the scientific community, to put it extremely mildly, also believes that all organisms evolved. And when they evolve functions to survive. And that's evident in their ecology, their anatomy, their physiology, everything they do. But purpose isn't one of those criteria.
Is part of your problem with the idea of nature in balance the fact that it sort of puts you in the center of the battles between creationism and evolution?
Not particularly. That's unique to the United States. Of all the countries in the world, the two countries who have the fewest people who believe in evolution are the United States and Turkey. So evolution is a firmly established scientific paradigm, but I thought that in formulating my argument about the balance of nature, as I describe it in the book, it would be useful to take a historical look at how it got to be where it is. And some of that is certainly in a very reasonable assumption that when you initially see the world and when you initially look at animals, you look at fish, for instance, and they're certainly well streamlined, most of them, that swim in the sea, and it looks like everything fits in a certain order, in a certain way. And, of course, because we think as humans, because we construct things that do have purpose, we naturally extend that idea to the natural world. The main purpose of my book was not to take on creationism. I don't really feel there's any need to do that in a scientific book. That's something that's unique to a part of the culture of North America that has absolutely nothing to do with what real science actually is. My objective in the book was to trace the history of the balance of nature argument, to even show how ecologists tried to adapt it to their empirical data sets in the 20th century. It was really like trying to drive a square peg into a round hole. And ecologists, when they eventually got the tools that were afforded by computers and other ways of dealing with large data sets, realized quite quickly that the concept of balance of nature was pretty useless.
Well, tell us about some of that history that you talk about, from its beginnings to where it's ended up now as a poor tool for ecology.
Okay. I suppose you could start by talking about the first real natural historian, and that was the Greek Aristotle, because Aristotle was a very, very sharp observer of nature. He took great interest in doing dissections. He took great interest in looking at animals in their natural habitat, and he was also part of the Socratic-Platonic concept of balance and concept of ultimate purpose. And Aristotle arranged all of the different life forms that he could identify into a great scala natura, the great chain of being, where one organism is more perfect than another and more perfect than another and more perfect than another up this ladder of perfection. And that was really the concept that got started the idea of a balance of nature. And when we jump many centuries to the 19th century, and we bring in Charles Darwin, who published The Origin of Species in 1859, we see an entirely different view of nature. Darwin's book is underestimated as to how exactly influential it was with regard to ecology in addition to evolutionary thoughts, because Darwin recognized changes in ecosystems due to all manner of reasons, whether it be invasive species or climate change, and he incorporated those things into The Origin of Species. But when we enter the 20th century, ecologists were still fairly ignorant about Darwin. They really didn't think very much about what we call an evolutionary time scale. Ecologists were pretty overwhelmed with the complexity of the natural world. When you go into any ecosystem, whether it's a meadow or a forest or the deep sea, you find so many different kinds of organisms and so many plants, so many animals, so many microbes, fungi, and you're trying to figure out, how does this all make sense? How does it all go together? What are the natural laws that determine determine what happens in this ecosystem. And ecologists quite naturally, and I think unassumingly, thought that there must be a natural equilibrium that's established in all ecosystems, and that's what they really sought to investigate. And so early work in ecology is filled with terms like balance of nature. But by the mid part of the 19th, or the excuse me, by the mid part of the 20th century, ecologists were dealing much more with what we call stochastic models, models that include large influences of chance, unpredictabilities, and they quickly learned that ecosystems really operate at different scales of space and time. In any given forest, for instance, some areas will be disturbed, some won't be, or less so. And some areas will be changing because of invasive species. Some areas will be changing because some species are becoming more or less abundant. And ecologists begin to realize that the picture of nature is more kaleidoscopic than balance. It's one of change, but the change can sometimes be quite rapid, perceptible easily to humans, or it can be quite slow, where it's like watching the hour hand of a clock. You know it's moving, but you can't for the life of you see it moving when you're watching it. And so ecologists have made a very significant transition in the last 40 years or so. I think I can safely say, and the Ecological Society of America is having its annual meeting in Albuquerque in a couple of weeks, and I think if any of them hear this, they'd agree, that very few ecologists put any credence whatsoever into the concept of balance of nature. I would be misrepresenting myself if I said I'm breaking new ground with this book. I'm really giving an account of what ecology has become. I'm in a vast majority of ecologists who believe that balance of nature is no longer a particularly fruitful way of looking at nature.
On the other hand, is it getting into the area of splitting hairs at all? Because if you look at some of the ways that we do try to manage nature, it seems as though we're trying to return it to some sort of state. If you look at prairie burnings or the way that we sometimes manage forest fires, isn't that managing nature to return it to some kind of balance?
If you want to use that term, you certainly can. I don't dispute the fact that we need to manage nature. I think it was Thomas Henry Huxley, the person who was the great defender of Darwin, who said that ecological ethics, or what we could call evolutionary ethics, are not based on leaving nature alone to do what it wants to do. It's based kind of on the analogy with a garden. If you want a garden, you have to manage the garden. You have to weed it. You have to put the kinds of plants in it that you want to grow there, and you have to exert energy to do that. And as we do these various things to maintain natural ecosystems, it's not really a balance that we're maintaining. We're trying to preserve the kinds of species, the kind of ecosystems that we want to see. And so when we go to the Galapagos Islands and shoot goats and kill cats and try to suppress invasive plant species because they would quickly outcompete the native fauna there, it's not a matter of preserving the balance of nature. It's a matter of preserving the individual groups of organisms that comprise that particular ecosystem. And so, of course, we need to manage nature. That is going to be one of the demands, it already is, of this century. And your example of burning prairies in order to allow the grasslands to persist is an excellent example. And managed burning was something that ecologists argued for back in the 1950s during the Smokey the Bear era, and it was a very difficult argument to make at the time because, and of course it's quite different, prescribed burning is quite different from an accidental fire set by somebody who throws a lit cigarette out of an automobile, but prescribed burning is absolutely essential to maintain grassland ecosystems. They will be eventually replaced by forests if that's not the case in most areas. But that's not really, if you want to look at that and saying, well, we want to keep a balance between grassland and forest, you certainly can, but it doesn't really mean anything in a scientific sense. On the other hand, prescribed burning means a great deal in a scientific sense.
Is the idea of the balance of nature, is that a dangerous one in the era we live in when it is of crucial importance that we stay on top of the way nature is managed and what our effect is on it?
I don't think it's a dangerous idea to think of balance of nature. I think it's just an irrelevant idea. I think what's dangerous is that if we don't realize how much we are going to need to involve ourselves with issues of what you would call the natural world, because the impact of humans, whether it's populations in some areas or whether it's the ecological or energy footprint of people in developed countries, is really reducing biodiversity. And I think one of the things that humans have to decide, one of the great questions that for my students, for instance, in this century, is going to be the degree to which we involve ourselves with thinking about and considering the worth of biodiversity on Earth and what we do about it. Because as we see more and more changes and more rapid changes in ecosystems that are coming about because of climate change and because of human activities other than climate change, then that question becomes really on the front burner. And I don't see it as a question of maintaining the balance of nature, but I do see it as a question of environmental ethics. Just what does the natural environment mean to us, and what are we willing to invest ethically in its preservation?
When you talk about the worth of biodiversity, what is at stake there?
That's a good question. The stakes could be fairly significant, and this is one of the areas in ecological research that is most prominent right now. There are several questions you can ask in a scientific framework about biodiversity, and the most obvious question is, what is the relationship between biodiversity, between the diversity of all organisms in an environment, and the function of that environment? Not the purpose of it, but the function. By that I mean, how much of the sun's energy does it obtain? How effectively does it put oxygen out in the atmosphere? How effectively does it recycle nutrients and minerals in the soil? How effectively does it renew watersheds? And that sort of those are the sorts of variables that ecologists are investigating with regard to biodiversity. And the most simplistic way to think of that is, if you start to reduce the biodiversity, are you starting to erode those things we call ecosystem services, the things that nature provides for us, essentially free of charge: air purification, water purification, cross-pollination of plants, that sort of thing. And so that is one area of ecological research that's being done all over the world. There are long-term ecological research projects that are occurring in all areas of the Earth, tropical, temperate, and polar ecosystems, looking at the relationship between biodiversity and ecosystem function. I'm finding some real correlations of interest there.
So you see that as being the big question of our time, then?
There are many big questions of our time, but given the rate of ecological change that's going to characterize the 21st century, yes, that would probably be in the top 10, if not top 5, significant questions. But I do find that sometimes questions are so daunting that they literally scare folks away. And I think some of these large ecological questions fall fairly closely to that category. But nonetheless, humans are capable of confronting these sorts of things, thinking about them in constructive ways, and I think that hopefully will happen in this century.
We need to take a quick break right now, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation this morning with John Kreischer, who is the Manili Professor of Biology at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, and he's the author of the book we're talking about this morning. It's called The Balance of Nature, Ecology's Enduring Myth. And we'd love to get your voice in our conversation this morning as well. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Do you believe in the balance of nature? And what do you think are the big questions that are going to arise? And what is our relationship to those questions in terms of how we view nature, whether in balance or a separate entity? The number 1-800-642-1234. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 12:30 today on Wisconsin Public Radio, join us for Chapter a Day as Carl Schmidt reads from The Other by David Gooderson. It's a novel about youth and idealism, adulthood and its compromises, and two powerfully different visions of what it means to live the good life. And then at 1 o'clock, it's Talk of the Nation. Today, a program called the Harlem Children's Zone does whatever it takes to help disadvantaged kids in Harlem succeed. Does it work? Decide for yourself after 1 o'clock on Talk of the Nation. I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with John Kreischer, the Manili Professor of Biology at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, and he's the author of the book The Balance of Nature, Ecology's Enduring Myth. That's the book we're talking about this morning. And we go now to the telephones and take our first call from Trevor in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me on. I'm a
sure.
big fan of public radio and everything you guys do for the world.
Fantastic.
I had a question for John. I agree with your stance that we need to take an involvement in nature, but then you start bringing things up like this ethical line. And who sets this ethical line? Is this something that comes from the university? Is this something that comes from the government? Ethics are different across the board. You know, to what purpose does our involvement in nature strive for?
Oh, that's a really good question, Trevor. I'm glad you asked it. I wish I had a simple answer, but I think my answer is that in the case of nature, I think, and what will happen in this century, I think the ethical line will be set eventually by society itself, just as we are struggling with other issues that I think involve ethics. There's a lot of divergence in our society about gay marriage, for instance, which I think most people would say is a strongly ethical issue. And some people believe that the ethics of that are simple and straightforward. Others believe they're simple and straightforward in a very different way. So it's a societal debate. And I think with regard to issues such as biodiversity and balance of nature and all that sort of thing, as I said, I don't believe there's a balance of nature, but I think there's a real need for environmental and ecological ethics. And I think we're going to need to decide as a society, and we'll decide it through our usual debate and discussion, I suppose, as to what worth we place on organisms such as polar bears, for instance, which are going to feel the effects of climate change in this century, and how we want to regard those kinds of creatures. Could the world exist without polar bears? You bet it can. I don't know of any ecologist who would say, if you don't have polar bears, the dominoes are going to begin to fall and the world's going to unravel. But on the other hand, what worth do we place in having them in the world? We certainly place a great deal of worth in art museums, for instance. We have natural museums of art. We don't allow people to go into those museums and mark up the paintings. We don't allow them even to photograph the paintings in some cases because of the effect of the flash. And so I think it's possible for humans, for us as a society, to decide on a kind of museum approach to part of nature and to recognize natural organisms as art forms of a sort that we value, that we think enhance our own intellect and worth, and that we set aside areas where they can thrive. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge comes to mind in the debate over that. So I think to answer your question, which is really cutting to the very issue itself, I don't see that the ethics are going to come from on high. I think we're going to have to derive them from within our society and what we consider as a people to be worth saving and preserving, and what we want our legacy as a culture to be.
The ethics of ecology seems like an area that we don't have that much practice in, certainly not with our feet to the fire.
No, we don't, but it's that's a very good point. But we are going to have to do that because there are going to be many issues that really push us in that direction. For instance, as medical science developed, the science of medical ethics, or the concept of medical ethics developed along with it, and medical ethics is a very well-established field and is taught in all colleges. And I think virtually all students in medical school today have courses in medical ethics, and it becomes a very strong part of their training. And I think environmental ethics, ecological ethics, if you want to call it that, is also starting to appear more and more frequently in college-level analyses, and this is where ideas begin, and then they move from there into society in general. So hopefully at the end of the century, the field of environmental or ecological ethics will be far, far more sophisticated than it might appear to be today.
Do we have that long?
Sure, we have that long, I think. There's going to be a cost to not acting, but I know that there are some individuals who are quite concerned over the rate of change on Earth and what it may portend for this century, and I don't pretend that the only difficulties our planet faces this century is in the ecological sphere. If you look at the socio-political concerns, those are, to put it mildly, quite daunting. But as far as ecology is concerned, and as far as the natural world and the sorts of things I wrote about in my book are concerned, I think we do have a time to have that discussion, to make those decisions. And so, yes, I'm not daunted by that, and I encourage my students to take an active role in that sort of debate.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Trevor. Great questions. And we'll move on now to Fern from Gilbert, Minnesota. Hi, Fern.
Yes. I agree with the speaker in some aspects and have some points of disagreement on others. We are dependent on the natural world and on its life-sustaining functions. Referred to Plato. Plato speaks of five kinds of love, but nothing about love of the earth. And I've given a little thought to why we trash the earth, and I think part of it is that we are simply in love with ourselves. The speaker used the word manage nature, and the word manage to me implies some kind of control. And where one human being tries to control another, there generally is trouble. We're facing sulfide mining in northern Minnesota, and so this brings up ethical issues. Minnesota does not have as strong laws as Wisconsin, who got into trouble with Kennecott and so passed legislation. But the mining companies are saying that they will live up to our laws and even exceed them. Well, the laws are very weak, and we need something on the books that says that no mining permit would be granted if they cannot prove that water would not have to be treated into perpetuity. And sulfide mining has health effects with methylmercury eventually being produced, and which is responsible for fish advisories, destruction of our wetlands, endangered species, and so on. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Fern. John Kreischer?
Fern, you raised some very good points, and we're not in as much disagreement as you may think. I quite agree with you about the Platonic ideals of what to value and the fact that Earth and natural systems weren't among them. I think the reason for that was largely that Earth and if anything, something that was seemingly was inexhaustible. Humans, for much of human history, have been, if anything, daunted by the diversity and breadth of the natural world. And it was only really in the 19th and 20th centuries when humans became significantly powerful as a species to start rapidly altering the world that we began to realize that it's not inexhaustible. And I remember back in the 1970s, an analogy was used quite frequently because this tied into the space program and the trips to the moon, that we were going to have to give up a cowboy economy and take on a spaceship economy, where everything in a spaceship is there to be recycled and carefully kept controlled, and where the cowboy view is that it's inexhaustible. You can just, all the rangeland you want and that sort of thing. And so what's really happening in the latter part of the 20th century and should continue in this century is that a lot of things that were economic externalities, and you're talking about them with your example there of the mining, where companies could feel free to degrade the earth because there was so much earth, who cared? The slogan was, the solution to pollution is dilution. Well, that doesn't apply anymore, and you know that, and I know it, and there has to be restrictions on and there have to be costs associated with the use of the planet. When I said manage, I also meant to imply that the museum model, that by management we should be actively controlling things like invasive species and encouraging the propagation of populations. For instance, I'm fully approving of putting wolves back into Yellowstone ecosystem because wolves were a very strong component of that system and exerted what ecologists call a top-down effect in controlling elk populations to the degree that the elk did not overbrowse aspens and other things. That's not really a balance of nature. It's just a chain of energy among organisms. But I really believe that humans have to take responsibility for their actions, exactly like what you're describing in frustration and the example that you you applied or that you mentioned. So I think we're much more in agreement than we are in disagreement.
Thank you so much for your call, Fern. And we'll move on now to Rand in Spencer. Hi, Rand.
Hi, it's Rand in Stetzer, but that's okay. John, I'm wondering, and I haven't read your book, but I'm wondering if, you know, the term balance of nature was probably used for centuries before we even thought of the word ecology and any such feelings that there is a functional ecosystems. But now my question is, do we wait for ecology in science and scientific studies to prove that something has value, something as a polar bear, you said, is important to the functional ecosystems of the Arctic. We don't know. Ecosystems are so complex that if we wait for scientific proof to save something, I think it'll be too late. So is there a way that we should be considering taking, as you even mentioned a little bit, that the importance of empirical data and observation in just taking, because it's so complex, just taking this data and assuming this will push us towards an ethic. I think there needs to be a change in attitude. I'd like to know your opinion on that.
Oh, I quite agree with you. My opinion is that we're in total agreement. I'll give you an example of that. The word ecology, incidentally, was not invented until 1866. So you're quite right that the term balance of nature has a long history compared with the word ecology. But the word ecology is derived from the same Greek root, ekos, as the word economics. And it was used to describe what was called the economics of nature. And so we never think of a balance of economics. We don't think of a balance of money or a balance of corporations. We see economics as a very evolving system of interactions among very complex groups. And ecology should be thought of in the same way. As far as your point about the rate at which science moves, in my book, I try to argue that, indeed, we don't have to wait for science. There is nothing wrong with supporting conservation of charismatic organisms such as jaguars, tigers, polar bears, because in doing so, that also confers some measure of protection for the ecosystems that they're in. And I don't think humans need to wait for science to follow their hearts with regard to their attraction and to the appeal that the natural world has. Conservation isn't necessarily something confined to science. It's something that should be shared with the arts, with literature, and it goes far beyond science. But on the other hand, if scientists don't focus on making some kind of an attempt to really ascertain what it is that biodiversity does in ecosystems and to see exactly what its impact and importance is, then I think they're missing a very important research agenda. So I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. And indeed, in my chapter in biodiversity, I begin by talking about how I think it's important for society to really think about the appeal, just the aesthetic appeal, not talking about science here, of what nature is and its component species. Very good question.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rand. We appreciate your point of view. And I wonder, just to spin off of what Rand said there, if the idea of a balance of nature isn't in some way a useful idea, maybe for not ecologists such as yourself, but for the layperson who needs to find a way into a point of access into ecology and a way to connect emotionally. And if you're looking for people to become good stewards, maybe that's not a bad thing.
Oh, sure. And that argument's been made many, many times. And I know that in many people come at nature with very different viewpoints, and these things need not be, in terms of conservation goals, they need not be mutually exclusive. One of the obvious arguments is that many people who don't believe in evolution, who are creationists, nonetheless are drawn to nature and really love nature because they view it as the creation, and they really want to preserve it because they see it as reflective of the Creator's efforts on their behalf. So I don't think that there's a simple unidirectional approach to how we deal with nature. And I think that citizens can come to it from many different divergent viewpoints. But as a scientist, I come from it from a scientific viewpoint, and that's what's expressed in my book. But I don't disrespect others who have viewpoints that are otherwise and nonetheless believe strongly in the what I think is a human mission to conserve the natural world.
We'll leave it there for the moment because it's time for a quick break as we pause our conversation with John Kreischer, who is the Manili Professor of Biology. He teaches at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, and he's the author of the book we're talking about this morning. It's called The Balance of Nature, Ecology's Enduring Myth. And we have an open phone line for you if you'd like to engage this morning and tell us what you think about the idea of a balanced natural world. And whether or not we risk anything by aligning our belief with an ordered natural world. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 is our call-in number, and our email address is another great way to reach us. It's talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's a lot to look forward to today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Larry Mueller is in to taste test some delicious Wisconsin artisan cheeses. His guest is Jeannie Carpenter of Oregon, Wisconsin, the creator of the organization Wisconsin Cheese Originals. And then at 11:30, Larry Mueller is talking about dining out, and he's joined by the chef and co-owner of The Dining Room in Monticello, Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert, glad to be with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. This morning, we're talking with John Kreischer. He teaches biology at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, and he's the author of the book, The Balance of Nature, Ecology's Enduring Myth. And John Kreischer, you tell it's kind of a funny story on the one hand, but it's also pretty loaded on the other about when you were called upon to testify or give your experience, rather, about mosquito spraying and how that was received in your hometown. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Oh, yeah, it's a true story. This was in I won't name the town, but it was in a town in New England, and in southeastern Massachusetts, periodically suffers from mosquitoes that carry eastern equine encephalitis, triple E as it's called. Fortunately, that is relatively infrequent. It comes every 4 or 5 years that some mosquitoes are infected with triple E, and then it becomes quite dangerous because they can pass that to humans, and it is a potentially, in fact, a fairly highly fatal disease. What happened was I was a fairly new professor at the time. This was a number of years ago, and I was called upon to go to a town meeting and asked to speak against the spraying that was planned for the town because of the mosquitoes. Well, at the time, there was no triple E present in the mosquito population. It wasn't a year that triple E was present. At least it wasn't at the time they did all the sampling, and yet the citizens, you know, were concerned. And so I tried to explain, as from a scientific perspective, that if you expose these mosquitoes to levels of insecticide, I think this was an organophosphate insecticide, I can't remember the name of it, they would begin to evolve resistance. And you would kill a great many of them, but those that survived would largely be more resistant to that insecticide than the ones that succumbed. And so you're starting a selection process where you're making more and more robust mosquitoes so that when you actually are confronted with mosquitoes carrying Triple E, you have more of a problem. It's going to be harder to kill them. And so this is analogous to when you go to your doctor and you say, "Doctor, I have an earache. Give me an antibiotic." And the doctor says, "I don't think I will, because I don't. First of all, you're going to get well, and second of all, I don't want you developing antibiotic-resistant bacteria in you." Well, one of the people just couldn't grasp the argument, or wouldn't grasp the argument, and stood up and yelled at me, "Do you want to kill my baby?" And as I said in my book, this is an uncomfortable thing to face, having someone accuse you of wanting to kill her baby. But, the point of the example really was that science does have a lot to offer to decisions about environment, and that evolutionary biology is very much tied up with ecology. You really can't understand ecology today without understanding evolution. And when you understand evolution, you have to consider ecology. And we are an evolved species, so we're part of that process. And what I was trying to get at in that example, in part, is that it's just really important for scientists to try and go to the general public. After all, much of science is supported by public money, and really explain what we do, what we learn, and why it's important to them. I didn't have much success that night because that was an emotionally charged meeting, but indeed it did occur.
And you had a friend who sort of tried to comfort you, didn't you?
Yes,
and she said, "It's all right, you just couldn't explain..."
Yeah, what she said to me was, I know you meant well, and I know that mosquitoes obviously have some purpose in the world, but you just couldn't explain what it was. And that got me, of course, thinking, oh, no, was I really that bad? So the point of the chapter, which is titled "Of What Purpose Are Mosquitoes," is to fundamentally say that in an evolutionary sense, mosquitoes don't have a purpose. Mosquitoes certainly have important functions as organisms, and they have a great impact on many, many kinds of organisms. But I don't think they have a purpose.
Well, I've got some callers waiting to talk to you, so let's go back to the phones with Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity. This is very interesting.
You're welcome. A couple of points.
A couple of ironies. One of them is that many of the things that we could do and need to do to preserve diversity in our environment would probably be good for us and would save us money in the long run, and may well be good for our economy. Another irony that I see is it seems, now there's a broad range of opinion, but many of the people who call themselves conservatives or who would label themselves conservatives do not seem to sense that this is a conservative issue to conserve our environment and our diversity and so forth. It's all tied in our agriculture and, of course, in our energy, in our transportation systems and also our military have tended to run roughshod over these types of tiny creatures and so forth, because who needs them, and they're not important. So that's my comment. I just happened to see a T-shirt the other day that kind of, it's truer than the person maybe thought. It said, it had a picture of the Earth from outer space, and it said, "Preserve our planet. It's the only one with beer."
That's great. I like that. I'm going to feel free to tell my friends that slogan. But you're talking to a kindred spirit here. But I do think that I have many friends who are conservative or have some conservative leanings, and their concern seems to be that as conservatives view things, the activities of those of us who see the need to take a more proactive direction in ecological matters of the earth and stewardship are, in fact, interfering with individual rights to develop the resources of the earth for profit, which has always been, in their view, the primary and the most successful approach to the resources offered by earth. And I think that I certainly talk about this in my book, but I think that's going to have to change really rapidly, not in a way that undermines capitalism or profit, but in a way that incorporates the real costs of what we're doing. And as you say, if you look at the real costs, and if you take a look in an economic, not an ecological alone, but in an economic ecological analysis of things like the use of mangrove forests that border many areas in the tropics, you'll find that if you cut the mangrove forests and you allow shrimp growing, you'll produce profits for the corporation that grows the shrimp and for those that are associated with it. But the average individuals will lose because those areas are now far less protected from the inundations of monsoons and tropical storms the fertilization effect that the mangroves have on renewing the resources of the sea that borders the area are undermined. And these are the kinds of transitional ways that ecology and economics are going to have to move in this century. The old notion of if I can tame it and cut it down and make a profit, that's fine, I think will give way to a more sophisticated economics that takes a broader view and incorporates variables that traditional economics hasn't really done.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Dave. And one more from Will calling from Madison. Hi, Will.
Yes. I grew up north of Gilbert. That nice lady called in from Gilbert, Minnesota. That's northeastern Minnesota. And I'm almost 75 years old. And I'm glad that I lived when I did, because these nice biology professors, like this nice gentleman, sadly did not get a chance to grow up in the wilderness. I grew up almost near the Boundary Canoe area. Mm. And when there was no welfare. And so the farmers, small farmers, had to control the predators and raptors. Any hawk, owl, or anything got the chickens. Any wolf that came down from Canada and they never checked in through customs, they trapped them, you know, kept their numbers down. And we had lots of partridge. They were all over in the trees. Lots of ducks, you know. There were pheasants all over in the Dakotas. I mean, in other words, if you control the predators and raptors, you can increase other wildlife numbers tremendously. And lastly, the comment about that, you know, out west there and introducing wolves, let human beings, men, teach their boys how to hunt and control those wolves and control the elk numbers. And so, therefore, we will have the gun at home because, yes, we may need to start another revolution in America to get America back. It's our control rather than the banksters' control in Washington and New York. What do you say, young professor?
You might be surprised. I'm not a young professor, for openers, but one of the things I do, and I'm not going to tell you my age, one of the things that I do envy you is growing up in that Boundary Lands area. You probably are familiar with Aldo Leopold, who is from that general area, was from it, who wrote this absolutely magnificent book called A Sand County Almanac, where he looked at the patterns seasonally of all the changes that occurred in nature. And he wrote this essay called The Land Ethic about how much the land does for humanity and how we need to really figure out that we derive so much benefit from nature. So from that very region that you're describing came one of the fundamental underpinnings of conservation biology. As far as your other points about individuals controlling nature as they see fit by shooting wolves, etc. Now, I don't agree with most of your points on that, and I certainly think that the overall benefit to the Yellowstone ecosystem of the reintroduction of wolves far exceeds any costs that are associated with that. And I also think that there's enough of a body of knowledge in conservation biology to, in fact, more wisely maintain ecosystems than just trusting individuals to teach their kids to shoot a deer every now and then. I don't disdain hunters at all, not at all. I think that, in fact, the duck hunters were singularly responsible for the creation of the National Wildlife Refuge System, which is one of the greatest advancements in conservation of the 20th century. If it wasn't for the duck hunters and their willingness to pay to preserve areas for ducks to migrate in winter, there would have been no ducks. They would have been all destroyed by hunting. But hunters were smart enough to know that wasn't what they wanted, and that's not what they did. So I have great admiration for that, and I'm not sure we disagree significantly, but in any case, I appreciate your point.
All right. Well, we have to leave it there. Maybe you can take that a compliment, a young professor, you know.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Beginning your career. Maybe you've aged well in your picture there, but thank you very much. It's been fun to talk to you, and it's been great to be opened up to these ideas. We appreciate your time this morning.
It's a privilege. Thank you, Veronica.
Thank you. John Kreischer is the Manili Professor of Biology at Wheaton College in Massachusetts and the author of The Balance of Nature, Ecology's Enduring Myth. Thank you to Sarah Carroll for answering your phone calls this morning and to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. If you'd like to buy a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program 728E. That's 728E. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'll be back with you tomorrow morning as well, starting at 9 o'clock. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.